We're holding on Nunbeis Amud Beis, three lines from the bottom. We're in the middle of talking about Ksubas Benin Dichrin, which is a takana that the Chachamim made, that like this, you have a woman has a ksuba. And let's keep in mind, the ksuba really has three parts. There's Iker Ksuba, which is the 100 or the 200 that the Chachamim required him to write for her, and he's not allowed to go below that. Then you have Tosfos Ksuba, where the husband can voluntarily on his own decide to add to the Ksuba. And then you have Nedunya, which is what the father put in, that he's gifting these particular nechosim to his daughter, and they're written into the Ksuba, and they become what we've called before Nichse Tzon Barzel, namely that the husband has the ownership of them. They become part of the marital assets, but he has to reimburse her for them if he dies or divorces her. So all those three things together make up the Ksuba. Now let's consider. We know, of course, that if the husband dies before her, or if he divorces her, then the ksuba has to be paid. Then that's that. If he divorced her, he's still alive, then he pays the ksuba himself. If not, then it gets paid out of the estate. What happens if she dies before him? So without any particular takana on that, what would happen is nothing. It means that he inherits everything that went into the ksuba, the ikur, the tosfos, everything he inherits, including the dowry, and that would be that. It becomes part of his assets, and eventually his heirs, whoever they are, inherit those things.
Was there bia already?
We're talking about there was bia already, okay. Let's say, yeah. Okay. Now, the Chachamim were concerned, as we learned in the Gemara yesterday, that a father might say, why should I bother giving a nice, good morning, Ellie. Why should I bother giving a nice Nedunya to my daughter, a nice dowry to my daughter, when not necessarily is it even going to stay in my family?
Yeah.
If my son-in-law has a second wife, as of course they were allowed to before Chaim Deben Geshem, then conceivably her children could end up inheriting it. Or if the guy dies childless, then his brothers are going to inherit it. It's completely going out of my family. Therefore, the Chachamim decided on the Ksubas Benin Dichrin, which is that we say, therefore, the deal is that if she dies before her husband, then the money that made up her Ksuba, the amount that makes up her Ksuba, again, the Iker, the Tosfos, the Nedunya, all of it is earmarked for her sons that she's going to have from him. So what happens, in other words, is, so we figure out, let's say the total, Iker plus Tosfos plus Nedunya, for a particular woman, was 400 zuz, let's say. So what happens is, therefore, 400 zuz of the inheritance of the estate is earmarked for her sons that she has from him. So therefore, when it comes time to divide the Yerusha, those sons of hers are going to get that 400, and then the rest of the estate is going to be split among all the Yerusha.
That's the deal that's called Ketubah.
So it's called Ksubas Benin Dichrin. Benin Dichrin. So Benin means children. Dichrin means males. So it means means sons. Benin Dichrin means sons.
Good.
And Ksuba, yeah. So the Ksuba of the male children. So we talked about that in the Mishnah, that is a Tanai based in, and it has to happen. We talked about in the Gemara, again, the reason behind it, in order to give an incentive to her father to give a nice size dowry, a nice size Nedunya, and we talked about some of the details of it. For example, now we're going to talk in more detail later on in the Masechta. We're going to talk about the various dinim of it. First of all, we said it applies only if there are boys. If it's girls inherit, even if it's girls inheriting, like you have with Slavchad and his daughters, then you don't have this. Then they just split the inheritance equally. The takana is specifically only if boys are inheriting.
Right.
Also, we said that there needs to be moiser dinner. There needs to be at least one dinner left that's not accounted for by the various ksuvas. So to take an example that I gave yesterday when we were learning this, let's say, so the guy has two wives. We'll call them Rachel and Leah. Rachel's total ksuba, including the Dunya and all, is 400. Leah's is 200. Now, each of them has sons from this husband. Now, if they both die when he's alive, means that 600 zuz have to be earmarked for their respective children to satisfy ksubas minin dichrin. We do that only if the Yerusha was 601 dinar or more. So that way, after we give out the earmarks, the ksubas benin dichrin, we still have at least one dinner to split among them. But if we don't have that, then we say that ksubas benin dichrin does not apply because the Chachamim did not want to completely override the Torah's dinim of Yerusha.
Mr. Shira's day with him.
Yeah, we had it yesterday on Travis afternoon, 5:55. Yeah. Okay. Next week it'll be a little earlier. Next week it'll probably be 5:45. Yeah. All right, so let's go on. We talked about also yesterday, by the way, is Ksuvas Minin Dichrin still in effect nowadays? The Rosh brings that maybe not. I mean, if the whole reason was in order to give an incentive to fathers to give a nice nedunya for their daughters, eventually, over time, it developed that people not only do that, they're sometimes more generous with the expenses for their daughters' weddings than for their sons. Maybe we don't need the takana anymore. So they say maybe it shouldn't be in effect anymore. Maybe also given that there's this Moser dinner business, it's not always so easy to calculate the exact value of the estate and to know whether it should be in effect. So on the other hand, maybe we say it should be in effect, but it can still be collected only from karka, like the original takana. So nowadays many people don't have karka, so it wouldn't apply. Or maybe as we said yesterday, Tosfos says that no, it's like the rest of the ksuba, it can even be collected from Metaltalin. So there are different opinions about it among Rishonim. So the Gemara tells in this connection, Rav Papa i'asik le'livrei be'aba surah. Rav Papa was arranging for his son's wedding with the household, meaning with the daughter of Abba Surah. Now Abba Surah was actually Rav Papa's own father-in-law. So Rav Papa had married Abba Surah's daughter. Now Rav Papa is arranging that his son is going to marry another daughter of Abba Surah.
Rav Papa
himself was married to a daughter of Abba Surah.
Okay.
Now, Rav Papa is arranging for the wedding of his son to another daughter of Abba Surah. Oh, now, obviously, wait. Obviously, we have to say the son must have been from a different wife, because if it was from the same wife, then another daughter would be also to him as his mother's sister. So we have to assume obviously it means that they were from different wives.
Okay.
Anyway, so Ozel L'michtav L'Ksubasa. So Rav Papa went to Abba Surah's house to arrange for the ksuba. Where there, they were going to have the negotiations for how much Abba Surah was going to give her for her nedunya that was going to become the nichset in Barzal. Shama Yehuda bar Meremar. So Yehuda bar Meremar heard that Rav Papa was coming. Nafik Osa Ischazile, and he came out to greet him. Out of respect, because Rav Papa was a distinguished Talmud Chacham, so Yehuda bar Meremar came to greet him. He was one of the Amiroim.
How is he connected to him?
Because he was a Talmud.
Is he a relative of Israel?
No, but apparently he was just a Talmud of Rav Papa, and he heard that Rav Papa is in town, so yeah. Ki motel pischa. So when they came to the door of Abba Surah's house, then Yehuda bar Meremar was going to take leave of Rav Papa to leave, because why would it be my business to be here? I'm not involved in this. I came along only out of respect to you, Rav Papa. So now that I accompanied you, now you're going to go into these negotiations. I have no business being there.
But you're just not connected to him.
Apparently not. Apparently Yehuda was not a relative of the family.
Well, why is it? So
like this, one second. Omalei, but Rav Papa tells him, Neo Mar Badoi. He says, Rebbe, come on in with me. Chazia Deloi have a nichale. But Rav Papa saw that Yehuda bar Meremar did not want to come in. Omalei, so he says, my daitach, why are you thinking, why do you not want to come in? Is it because you don't want to be involved in these negotiations, or you don't want to be here? Like, you think about it like this. When this is being done, ultimately, we're going to be writing out a shtar. We're going to be writing out a ksuba. You need edim for the ksuba. So Yehuda did not want to be one of the edim. So the Papa is saying, why not? Is it mishum de omale Shmuel of Yehuda? Is it based on what Shmuel says to Rav Yehuda? Shinina, he says, sharp one, which is Rav Yehuda, which is Shmuel's nickname for Rav Yehuda all over Shas. Either it means sharp one, or it means the one with big teeth. Or there's a couple of different explanations. Okay. Anyway, but he tells Rav Yehuda, loy tehavi ba'avuri achsanta. You should never be involved in transferring an estate. Afilu mi bara bishul bara tova, even from a bad son to a good son. Meaning, in other words, like this: we know the Torah tells us that if a person dies, then his children inherit his property. The bechor gets a double portion. All the other sons get a single portion each, and that's that. Now, of course, a person can write out a document, as we have all over Shas. A person can write out a document, a will, that says that he has other instructions of what he wants to do. Okay. He can even give away. We talked about the other day in the Gemara, for example, that he could be giving away his property while he's still alive to his children or to various other people.
He can do whatever he wants.
He can do whatever he wants. Shmuel is telling Rav Yehuda, when it comes to that you have a person is writing out a document where he's disinheriting or even partially disinheriting some of his children.
How do you see that?
Wait, 1 second. That's what we mean. Avuri achsanta means to transfer inheritance. Afilu mi bara bishul bara tova, even from a bad son to a good son, meaning you can have a person who says, you know what, I have a bad son. I don't want him to inherit what would otherwise be his fair share of the property. I want to disinherit him partly or completely, and I want to give that to somebody else. So you shouldn't even do that, says Shmuel to Rav Yehuda. Don't be involved in that. Delo yadia my zara nafik minei. After all, even a bad son, he himself may be bad, but you never know. He may have good children, and they're going to end up inheriting that property, and therefore you shouldn't take it away from them. V'chol shekin, and all the more so, continues Shmuel, mi bara lebrata, where you're transferring part of the estate from a son to a daughter. Because after all, mitzad, from the din of the Torah, daughters don't inherit. So what are you doing? So fine, the father has the right to give some of the property to his daughter, but it doesn't mean that the Chachamim approve of it, and therefore Shmuel is telling Rav Yehuda, you shouldn't be involved in that as a dayan or an aide or whatever.
How is he transferring from the son to
Because now he's giving a nedunya to his daughter. What's going to happen? The whole point of Ksubas bin Indichrin is that money is never returning to his own sons. The idea is it's becoming part of this daughter's marital estate, she and her husband. Eventually, if she has sons with him, as would usually be expected, then those sons are going to yaushin it. If not, then it'll be whoever the husband's heirs are going to yaushin it. Either way, it's being taken away from Abba Surah's other sons. Oh. So therefore, so Rav Papa is telling Yehuda bar Marema, is that why you don't want to be involved? By the way, as far as this isn't really the place to discuss this in detail, it's in Bava Basra, but the as far as this business of not transferring inheritance, it's actually not so. We do find, first of all, we find Avraham Avinu did that he disinherited Yishmael and the Bnei Pilagshim in favor of Yitzchak, and there's a number of explanations how he could do that, given our Gemara over here. One simple answer is that since Hashem had told him, Kibi Yitzchak, Yikara L'chazara, that only Yitzchak is considered your legitimate heir, then that's different.
How did he determine?
Because Hashem had told him.
What was he going to give to Yishmael?
He had an estate, right, before Avraham died.
Whatever,
he had money, he had animals, he had lands, whatever he had exactly. The point is, the Pasuk says, he gave everything to Yitzchak, and to the Bnei Pilagshim, he just gave them presents and sent them. But the point is, he didn't give them their fair share. So, like this,
Did he give a smell present?
He had eight sons. He had Yishmael, he had Yitzchak, and he had the six Bnei Pilagshim.
Right.
But he did not divide the estate into eight and give one-eighth of it and give each of the others.
No.
Why not? So one answer is, Kibi Yitzchak Yikar al-Chazara. Anyway, I was going to say that there is actually an interesting tshuva of Rav Moshe on the subject of Rav Moshe Feinstein, where he says, when our Gemara is talking about over here, Bara Bisha and Bara Tova, bad son or a good son, we mean relatively bad. We mean that, you know, Okay. We mean, in other words, you know, he's maybe not so erlich. He's maybe, you know, he's maybe not so respectful to his parents. He's maybe not so 100% honest in business or whatever. But he says, for example, when you have a son, or Chas v'Shalom, a person has a son who's an out and out Russia, then Rav Moshe says that's not what that can be another answer for Avram, because his other children were out and out Rishoyim, and therefore he's entitled to disinherit them. And Rav Moshe says that's not what the Gemara is talking about over here.
Right.
Then even though it's true that he might have children who are Baalei Tshuva, but that's a remote enough possibility that the father doesn't have to be concerned about that. Anyway, getting back to the Gemara over here. So, Rav Papa says to Yehuda bar Marema, so you're concerned, you don't want to be an aide or to be involved in any way in this, because it amounts to taking away part of the estate to give it to the daughter, and you hold, and you're saying that Shmuel said you shouldn't do that. You should know, says Rav Papa, hai nami takanta de rabbanani. The fact is, this to give an dunya is also a takana of the Chachamim. Namely, that we brought in the Gemara yesterday, Rabbi Yochanan brought in the name of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, the reason for Ksubas ben Indichrin, and in fact, it was based on a Pasuk in Yirmiyah. Now, Rabbi Mao Shah points out that the Pasuk is really only an Asmachta, which is why we're speaking of Takanta de Rabbanan. If the Pasuk was really a solid proof for it, then we would call it Daraisa. But because even though it's a pasuk from Nevi'im, still we would say the Nevi'im can't come up with new halachas on their own. It would mean that it was a halacha l'Moshe Mitzrayim that the Nevi'im were told to write down. But in this case, since we're saying Dirabbanan, then it means that it means that the pasuk is only an asmachta. Anyway, therefore, the Papa says, so you've got nothing to worry about. That's not included in what Shmuel is saying. Amalei, but Yehuda Bamarema says, that's different. Hani mili midaite, that's if the father on his own wants to give a nadin, then it's a good thing. La'asuye nami, are you talking about though to pressure him to give more? If I'm there, then what else do you bring me in for if not to pressure him?
Well,
that's what he's figuring. What do you need me there for? If not, Omale, Rapapa says, Alter me kamin aloch to Uva Asye. What do you think? I'm telling you to go in and pressure him? Uva lai ta Asye kamin. All I mean is go in there and sit in there, be there when the negotiations are going on. You don't have to pressure him, just you'll be there. Omale, Omale, me. Do you think I'm telling you to Uva Asye to go and pressure him? Uva lai ta Asye kamin. I'm saying go in and don't pressure him. Omalei, so he answers him, Ma'aloi didi, when just me going in, Hainu Asiya, that itself amounts to pressure. Uh-huh. Because of my covered, apparently Yehuda Bar Merema was an important Talmid Chacham, uh-huh. Abba Surah is going to feel that if I'm there, he's under pressure to give a greater nadin because I'm involved. Rapapa convinced Yehuda Bar Merema, Va'ul, and he went in and was sitting. Ishtik. So he's sitting over there quietly because he figures he doesn't have anything to mix in. Ishtik be Yosef. He was sitting there quietly. Sogar, now Abba Surah, who remember is the father-in-law that we're talking about over here, Sogar, he thought, Hahu Mirtach Rotach. He, Abba Surah, thought, Mirtach Rotach. Why is Yehuda Bar Merema? Why is Yehuda Bar Merema sitting there and being quiet? It must be because he's angry. It must be because he's disappointed and angry that I'm giving so little for my daughter's nidun. So he ended up writing out a document saying that everything that he has goes for his daughter's nidun.
Yeah.
Well, soif amalei, but and still Yehuda Bar Merema didn't speak up. Well, soif amalei, so eventually. Abba Surah says to him, Hashta Nami Le Mishtoi Mar, what Rebbe, even at this point, you're still not calm down, please. Okay. Calm down, please. Omale, Hashta Nami Le Mishtoi Mar, Rebbe, you're still not speaking? Are you still angry with me? You think I haven't done enough? Chaya Demar, I swear by the Rebbe's life. Lo Shviki Midi Le Nafshoi, I haven't even left anything for myself. I've given everything I've got. What do you want from me anymore? Omale, so Yehuda Bar Merema says, the reason I was quiet until now because I was angry. It's because I figured I don't have to mix in. But now he says, if it were up to me, I feel a high nami de kaspas le'nichali. On the contrary, I wouldn't be satisfied even with what you wrote in the first place, because after all, as we said before, it is in a certain sense taking away from the Yerusha, from the perspective of Yerusha of the sons. So I would have said that you should do less. I certainly don't mean that you should do more. Amalei, so Abba Surah says Hashtanami ahead of. Okay, then in that case, let me go back. I only promised all of my nechassim because I thought that otherwise you would disapprove of me. Now that you're telling me that in fact you would have preferred I give even less than I did in the first place, then I'll reduce it. Amalei, but Yehuda Bar Merema tells him, no, Shavya Nafsha Chadauna Loi Kamina. I didn't mean that you should retract. You shouldn't be a person who retracts from what he said. You did promise this amount, so therefore you should hold yourself to that. It's true that mitzad the halacha, you would be allowed to go back. Tosfos points out, now there are cases where once a nedunya is decided and then the kiddushin takes place right then, Then it's too late. However, here Tosfos says either the kiddushin had been previously done, so now it's not dvarim aniknim ba'amira. So therefore, Abba Surah would be within his rights to retract. But Yehuda Bar Merema is telling him you shouldn't do that. The fact is, you did promise, and a yid should hold himself to his words. But nevertheless, said no. It's to begin with. I would have disapproved of you doing that. because it's too much. And as it is, the amount that you said to begin with was also too much. So what do we learn from this story? I guess we learn, Chachamim Hizaru to Bedivreichem, and not only Bedivreichem, but even in what you don't do. Like this, Yehuda Bamarema was sitting there not saying anything, and Abba Surah misunderstood it. So therefore, so I guess we learn from that, that a Tamid Chacham has to be careful, not only what he does say, but what he doesn't say, what people might mistakenly derive from it. Okay, onward.
Why do we need this story when we know that Halacha says that you're not supposed to give more than 20%?
So first of all, it's not necessarily the Halacha says that. The Halacha says that you're not supposed to give for tzedakah more than 20%. We talked about yesterday, Rashi learns that when we said 10%, it means that's the average, but you're allowed to go beyond that. Tosfos had said you're not supposed to go beyond 10%. But here, evidently the idea was that Abba Surah thought he was doing the right thing in order to satisfy the great Tamid Chacham Yehuda Bar Maremer. He didn't realize that Yehuda Bar Maremer would actually have wanted him to do less. So it was a misunderstanding, but we have the story. I guess, first of all, it shows us that there can be valid reasons to go beyond. If Yehuda Bar Maremer, in fact, had told him, you know what, this isn't enough, you need to add more, then it would have been right for him to add more. It was only that there was a misunderstanding, that he hadn't said anything, and Abba Surah himself jumped to conclusions. And like I say, I guess we can also learn from this story that a Tamid Chacham, like Yehuda Bar Maremer, has to be careful, not only what he says, but also what he doesn't say, because people may misunderstand his silence as meaning something that he didn't mean. So, yeah. Okay. Continues the Gemara. Bominei Rav Yemer Sova Mirav Nachman. Rav Yemer Sova asked Rav Nachman the following question. Mochruk Subasa Labaila. What happens if the wife sold her ksuba to her husband? Now we're going to have, here and there, later in the Masechta, there can be that she can, like this, she has her ksuba, she has her 100 and 200, she has her toast.
She can sell to anybody.
So to sell to anybody, we're going to talk about soon. Right now, we're talking about where she sold it to her own husband, meaning, in effect, that she's saying to her husband, so you know what, let's say my ksuba, the total amount, the ikar toastfest plus nadunya amounts to, let's say, 400 zuz, give me 400 zuz now, and in the future, you won't have to pay me my ksuba. So now the question is, yesh laksubas benin dichrin, ayayin laksubas benin dichrin. Does that forfeit the ksubas benin dichrin, or does it not? Now, the real question is that Rishonim ask, we know that a husband and wife are not allowed to stay married without a ksuba in effect. If she's selling him her ksuba, meaning in other words, now, by the way, there can be two ways where she sells him her ksuba. One can be where she gets the full amount, and the other can be what's called betoivas hana, which we're going to discuss soon in the Gemara, meaning, she says, you know, when you think about it, ksuba is, you can never be sure. I might die first, and in that case, it becomes part of your estate, and you just have to earmark it for my children, for my sons. Or it might be that you die first, or you divorce me. I'm saying she's saying to her husband. Okay. She's saying to her husband, you know, you think about it, there could be where you die first, whatever. Okay, fine. You could have where she says to her husband that he could die first and then she has to be paid the ksuba, all of it, ikur nadunya plus ikur tosfos plus nadunya. Or it could be that he divorces her or she dies, or same thing, if he dies first or he divorces her. Or it could be that she dies first and then the ksuba just becomes, all these three things become part of the estate and eventually it goes to her sons. So it's always a contingent thing. So therefore, you can have that the ksuba is sold the tovas hana, meaning it's not the full value, but rather like some kind of lesser value depending on the chances. If, for example, you think about it, if she's sickly and she's likely to die first, then the value of the ksuba is going to be, the value of the ksuba to him is going to be lower than it would be if she's healthy and young, where she's likely to outlive him by many years. So that would be tovas hana, or it could be where she sells it for the full amount. Anyway, we're showing him, bring up the point. We know that a husband and wife are not allowed to stay living together if there's no ksuba in effect. If she sells no ksuba, how are they allowed to stay married? So there's a few answers. The Rif brings in a tshuva that one possibility is that she did it right before she died, and then shortly afterwards, before they had a chance to write a new ksuba, then she died. There's a couple of other answers. The Rashba brings from the Ravid that what we mean is, yeah, then they wrote out a new ksuba, but in the new ksuba, they did not write ksubas benin dichrin. So now the question is, given that she's in effect, she seems to have foregone that, Does that mean that indeed she can forego it? Or do we say it's a takana of the chachamim, and therefore it's in effect whether she foregoes it or not? And then there's other answers as well. But anyway, the point is that so is ksubas benin dichrin in effect or not? Omalei Rava. So Rava says to Rav Yema Saba, why are you asking about the case where she sells her ksuba to her husband, which is less common? V'tiboy lach mecheles. Why don't you instead ask about the case where she's moichel her ksuba to her husband, which is more common? Omalei, so Rav Yema says, hashta mecheres kami bayli. I consider when it comes to that she's selling, then I'm wondering about whether it means that ksubas benin dichrin is being foregone. The afagab de ikal mema zuzi ansua, where after all, when she sells it, you could always say that she was kind of forced into it. She was short of money, and therefore she decided, you know what, this is a good way to raise money. The amina, which I would say, that kind of situation where a person is short of money and they need to do something unusual like that is the equivalent of as if they had been whipped 100 times with an uchla. Literally, an uchla means an uchla is a very small measurement. The Gemara in Baba Basra mentions a whole catalog of measurements. You have a lug and a half a lug and a toymen and an uchla. So an uchla technically is a very small size container. But here we're using it in the sense, sometimes you have a whip that has little pieces of metal attached to it that are the size of an uchla. So therefore, mea uchli b'uchla literally means being whipped 100 times with a whip that has little uchlas attached to the end of it, which of course would be very painful.
What is this whipping a little bit?
What we mean is metaphorically, the fact that she is suffering from, she doesn't have cash on hand and she needs it for whatever purpose she needs it. And now therefore she figures, you know what? I have an alternative. I have an asset that I can sell for this purpose, namely my ksuba. It's the equivalent, the fact that she needs the money is the equivalent as though she was being whipped. So therefore, we can say that there was a degree of onus involved, and still we can talk about the question, does that mean that she's forfeited ksubas benin dichrin? So Rav Yema says, mecheles miboya, do you need to ask about mecheles? So Rashi says, I have the same question about mecheles, where after all, she's not anusa, so do we say that, because obviously if she's mechelet, she obviously doesn't need the money, so therefore, do we say the same thing, that she's forfeited the ksubas benin dichrin, or not? Tosfos learns differently. Tosfos says that when it comes to when she sold it, I have reason to think that maybe in fact she has forfeited ksubas benin dichrin. Yes, there was an onus. Yes, as if she was whipped. But the fact remains, she did sell it. So I would say that when it comes to mecheles, I think it would be obvious that there's no ksubas benin dichrin. So according to Rashi, Rav Yema is saying my question is on both of them, and according to Tosfos, he's saying my question is only on mecheles, but not on mecheles. Okay. Yeah. So that was Rav Yema Sava's question. So the Gemara continues, Omar Rava, Pshitali. Now Rava says, it's obvious to me, Mecheres Ksubasa La'acherim. Now if she sells the Ksuba to a third party, now that's different. Selling the Ksuba to her husband is, we said, in effect, we're saying that her husband is potter from paying her the Ksuba in the future. And then we can talk about whether the Ksubas Benin Dichrin is still earmarked for her children. When she's selling it to other people, then we're talking about she's selling it b'tovas hana. Again, the person is taking a risk. After all, remember, if she dies first, then there's no ksuba to be paid out. Then that person has lost the investment that he made. Okay. As opposed to if he dies first, or if he divorces her, then they can collect. Then when she collects the ksuba, then it goes to them. So she sells it to Tovas Hana. So Rava says it's obvious that if she sold the ksuba to other people, yesh lo ksubas minin dichrin, then ksubas minin dichrin is in effect. Because after all, even if she hadn't sold it, the husband would still yashin it. And then the Chachamim made this takana that it's earmarked for her children. So now you think of it, relative to her husband, her schus is not gone. All it is is instead of her husband paying her, if he dies or divorces her, instead of him paying her, he's going to pay that third party. But he still has the same obligation to pay out. It's different with Rav Yema's case where she was moichel it to her husband, or where she sold it to her husband, then her husband is not paying it out if she dies or he divorces her. if he dies or he divorces.
But Duke's been differing. Why do you have to get into that?
Just because we're discussing what we're talking about.
That's a different story.
No. We're saying Ksuba's been differing, again, remember, is that a certain amount of the Yerusha equivalent to the value of the Ksuba is earmarked for the children if she dies first. So now let's consider. She found a third party who's willing to buy her Ksuba b'tova sana, meaning that person is willing to make an investment. It's a contingent investment, because if she dies first, then he gets nothing. So now the question is, so how does it work now? So like this, if her husband dies or divorces her, then instead of paying the ksuba to her, he pays that to the third party. If she dies first, now becomes the question, do we say that if her sons inherit it, is it earmarked for them as ksuba spenindich? Or do we say that not? So Rava is saying it's definite that she does have ksuba spenindich, because after all, relative to the husband, things are no different. The husband's obligations as far as the ksuba are the same, whether she sold it to somebody else or whether he's giving it to her. As far as the fact that she sold it, my time is Zuzian Sua. Again, we can say the fact that she needed the money was considered an oinus, like we just said. It's as if she was being whipped, that she felt keenly the lack of money, and therefore we can't say that she forfeited the ksuba's been indifferent because of that. On the other hand, Rava continues, Mechelas Ksubas in the Bible. On the other hand, if she's Mechel Huksuba to her husband, Ema Ksubas bin Indichwin, then Ksubas bin Indichwin does not apply. So we said before, one second. According to Rav Yemar, we said before, Rashi understood Rav Yemar to be saying that he has the suffix either way. Tosva says that Rav Yemar had said, when it comes to Mechel, I know for sure she doesn't. So according to Rashi, Rava is answering part of Rav Yemar's suffix. And according to Tosfos, he's agreeing with Rav Yemar on that detail. So if she's moichel, then there's no ksubas ben indichrin. My timer, acholei achilta, because after all, she was moichel the ksuba. Obviously, she doesn't care about the ksuba even for herself. So therefore, we can say that she was also moichel it for her children. But Rava's question is, mecheres ksubas l'baila, if she sells the ksuba to her husband, which was Rav Yemar's topic. Do we say k'mecheres la'acherim dami, or k'mecheres l'baila dami? Do we draw an analogy from that? Do we say that selling is like selling, and therefore ksubas bin indichrin is still in effect? After all, when she sold it to her husband, she's really only also selling it for tovas hanah. She's not selling it for the full value necessarily, because why would the husband be willing to pay the full value of it? It's a contingent thing. He doesn't know for sure that he would ever have to pay out this money. There's always the possibility that she's going to die first, and it's going to become part of his estate. So therefore, he's not going to pay the full price. He's only going to pay Tovas Hanah. So do we consider it that the equivalent of selling it to somebody else? So therefore, it's the equivalent, and therefore, Ksubas Ben Indichman is still in effect. Or do we draw the analogy with when she was Moichel it to her husband? After all, because again, he still has the Ksuba under his possession. It's still, it's something that he eventually, now, like this, he would have had to pay it out under some circumstances. Like this, he doesn't. So maybe it means that she forfeited it for herself and for her children. So that was Rava's question, same as Rav Yema's question. Basa de Boya Hoder Poshta, after Rava asked the question, he later on answered it. Yes, Mecheres Tsubas Labaila, to Mecheres Lacherim Dami. Yes, it's the equivalent of selling it to somebody else, and therefore Ksubas Ben Dichwin is still in effect. So again, let's review. We're talking about she has a Ksuba, let's say the total Ksuba with everything that's written into the Ksuba altogether equals, let's say, 400 Zuz. She sold it to her husband for Tovas Hanah, so he paid her some small amount. That now, if he dies or divorces her, he won't have to pay her ksuba. Nevertheless, if she dies first, then ksuba's been in dichrin is still in effect, and that 400 zoz has to be earmarked for her sons.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So the Gemara says, "Masiv Rav Idi ba'oven." So Rav Idi ba'oven says, "I have a contradiction to that." We learn in a Mishnah Mesa that now we have a case like this. So we had a case in Yevamos. A woman whose husband went overseas, and one aide comes and tells her that her husband died. So she gets permission from Beis Din, and she goes and remarries. Now her original husband shows up.
She's in bad shape.
We have learned in Yevamos. There's a lot of penalties and consequences.
Didn't check it out. No variation.
She's a lot of penalties and consequences that she suffers, and among them is the Mishnah says Mesa, that if she dies, Ein Yoshin Shalzev, Yoshin Ksubasa. her inheritors, her children, from neither husband, Yarshin Huksuba. And now we discuss in that Gemara in Yeromus, what Ksuba? We said earlier in the Mishnah that she forfeits Ksuba as a result of this. So there's no Ksuba to be paid out anyway. So what do you mean that nobody yaushes Ksuba? And our Papa says we're talking about the Ksuba's been indichrin. So in other words, the Mishnah is telling us if she dies while either one of these husbands is still alive, then so her sons from one or from the other do not get the ksubas bin indichrin when eventually the husbands die and the respective estates have to be split up. So the amai, now if you're telling me that if she sells her ksuba, then nevertheless ksubas bin indichrin is in effect, why don't we say the same thing over here? And we said, why did Rava say that if she sells it even to her husband, then it's considered if she hasn't forfeited ksubas bin indichrin? Because we said zuzi ansua, the fact that she needed money was considered a form of onus. She felt under pressure to sell it because otherwise she needs to raise money. So why don't we say the same thing over here? V'amai, hochanami le'me yetzo onsa. Let us say that after all, she really wanted to be married. She didn't want to stay in Aguna or not only in Aguna, not even in Aguna, really. She thought she had one age. She figured her husband's dead. She didn't want to stay alone. So why don't we say then that it was considered a form of onus that she married the second guy? Fine, it turns out it was wrong. But the same way as we're saying here that the onus of needing money doesn't cause her to forfeit ksubas bin indichrin for her children, why don't we say the same thing over there? The answer is hosam knosahu to kansur rabbanan. The answer is that's different. It's not that we're not talking about whether there was an onus or not. There's a knas because yes, she wasn't careful enough to make sure that her husband is really dead. After all, we say why is it that we believe one aid in the first place? We learned in Yevamos isha daiko minsava. We expect her to take care to make sure that this aid is really telling the truth and that her husband is really and truly dead before she jumps and marries somebody else. She didn't do that. Therefore, that was carelessness. Therefore, the chachamim penalized her. So that doesn't show that in any other case of onus that we would say that ksubas bin indichrin is forfeited. Maybe in a regular case of onus we would, and only in that particular case is there that. Okay. The Gemara continues in this on this topic. Yosef Ravin bar Chinina kamed Rav Chista. Ravin bar Chinina was sitting as a Talmud in front of Rav Chista. The Yosef b'ka'amah mishmed Rav Elazar. He was sitting and saying in the name of Rav Elazar. Interesting little tidbit, by the way. All over Shas, you have this kind of expression that Pliny was sitting in front of Pliny and he was sitting and saying. Why the double expression sitting? So there's an interesting explanation. I think Ben Yehoyada says it, but I think it goes back maybe before him as well. I don't remember. The vote would be, so they're sitting in the Beis Medrash. When the Talmud wants to say something, he gets up to ask permission to say what he wants to say. And then when he's given permission, then he sits back down and say it. So there's therefore the double respect. Therefore, the double expression that Yosef, first he's sitting there as a Talmud, and then having gotten permission to say such and such, the Yosef, then he sat back down and said the following, the Shmei Rav Elazar. Mechelas ksubasa labayla, eima mezonis, that if she's moichel huksuba to her husband, then, so till now we were talking about ksubas bin indichrin. Now here's another point. If she's moichel huksuba to her husband, then from now on, So now, if her husband dies after that, she does not get mezonis. Because usually we said the almana is entitled to mezonis out of the estate until she remarries or until she collects uksuba. But here, where she was moichel uksuba, therefore she's not receiving a uksuba payout. Well, this is one of the tenoi uksuba. No uksuba, then no tenoi uksuba. Therefore, she's not getting mezonis from the yoshi. Omale, so Rav Chista says to Rav and Bachinina, if it weren't for the fact that you told me this in the name of a great person, in the name of Rabbi Elazar, so in other words, because you said it in the name of Rabbi Elazar, I have to accept that it's a valid point, but otherwise, I would tell you, I would quote you a pasuk to tell you that it shouldn't work. The pasuk says, "Meshiv ra'a tachas toiva," someone who repays good with evil. You did something good for somebody else, and the other guy does something bad back. A person who acts like that, evil will never go away from his house. Meaning, Rav Chista is saying, you think about it, she did the Yoshim a favor. She was moichel the ksuba, and that way they don't have to pay her out of ksuba. She's an almana. By definition, she would have had to receive the ksuba after her husband died, and instead she was moichel it, so now she's freeing them from that obligation. Because of that, they should be repaying her badly by saying you forfeited mezonis as well. So Rav Chista says, logically, you wouldn't say that. But Rav Elazar is saying it, so that's how it is. Now, is that in fact how it is? The Rambam, in fact, paskins that, in that case, that obviously Rav Chisda is willing to accept. Rav Elazar said this, so therefore, even though I don't think it's logical, I'm accepting it. So therefore, he says that's the halacha. But so the Rambam says, okay, so in that case, we have Rav Elazar saying this. We have Rav Chisda saying, I don't think it's logical, but Rav Elazar said it, so I'm willing to accept it. Therefore, that's the halacha. On the other hand, the Ra'ah, one of the great Rishonim, the Rebbe of the Ritva, and a Chava of the Rashba, and the Rebbe of the Ritva, says maybe not. The fact is, Rav Chisda is saying it doesn't seem logical based on the way the Pasuk phrases it.
What does he say?
So he says that, in fact, she would be entitled to mezonos. Yes, she forfeited her ksuba on the basis that she did him a favor. And meshivra tachas tov lo samu shra mibesik. So therefore, so the Ra'ah says that, in fact, maybe the halacha should be like Rav Chisda, and she would, in fact, be entitled to mezonos.
But for short, if they spoke this out and said, but mezonos, you'll have to...
Well, obviously, if she explicitly said, I'm forfeiting mezonos as well, there's nothing to talk about. We're talking about if she was willing to be mochel on uksuba. Okay.
They keep paying on mezonos probably comes out over years, coming up much more.
It depends. I mean, it depends whether she's young and healthy or whether she's old and sick. Yeah, probably a lot of different factors. Okay. More on this topic of what the more on the topic of ksuba and when it's in effect and when it's forfeited. So the Gemara says Yosef, Rav Nachman, Ula, Avimi, Bar Papi. These three Amoraim, Rav Nachman, Ula, and Avimi, Bar Papi, were all sitting together. The Yosef, Rav Chiya, Ba'ami, Gabayhu. Rav Chiya, Ba'ami was sitting together with them. Also, who gavra the shchiva arusase. There came a man to ask a shaila where his arusa had passed away. So he had been makadish a woman, and then during the year that they had, usually between kedushin and nisuin, she passed away. The question was: is he required to pay for the expenses of her burial? So Amrilay. So they said to him, Zilkvar, go pay the expenses of her funeral, of her burial, oihav loksubasa, or pay her, or rather her yoshim, her ksuba. Because after all, we learned the other day that the Chachamim made the Takana, he's obligated to pay for her burial in return for the Ksuba. So the Ksuba, the Pashtus means the 100 or 200, the basic amount of the Ksuba. Forget about Tosfos Ksuba, but we're talking about the basic amount of the Ksuba that the Chachamim were misakin. So now you've gained that. You're never going to have to pay that out. So therefore, either you pay that out now or you pay the burial expenses.
When do you have to get the Ksuba?
So usually the Ksuba is in effect only after the Nisuin. But if the Ksuba was already written out during the Erusin, then it takes effect then. So therefore he would have had to pay it out.
We don't give by dafka by chuppah.
Right. So but omalahu Rav Chiya, but Rav Chiya Bar Ami said to them, not necessarily, Tanena, we learn in a braisa, ishta yarusa, that if a husband's wife, that if his wife passed away while she's in arusa, loy oinin v'loy metamila, he does not have the dinim of aninus, or that he can be metame for her, meaning if he's a koyin. So if a koyin who's an oinin is not allowed to eat from kodshim, but because she was only an arusa, then he's not an oinin for her. He can still eat tonshim. If he's a koyan, he's not allowed to be matame for her burial, because that applies only after nisuin. V'chein he lo yainenes v'le matame loy. Similarly, she's not in aninus and is not matame for him. So as far as not being in aninus, it means that, again, if she would have otherwise been able to eat kodshim, she's still able to. She's not barred from eating kodshim because her chosin passed away. As far as the loy matame law, there's a few possibilities. Rashi says it means she's not chayet to be matame for him. Now, she's allowed to, because even the wife of a kohen or the daughter of a kohen is allowed to become tamei mes. It's only the male kohen also, but it means she's not required to. The other possibility that Rashi mentions elsewhere, we learned this in Yevamos as well, is it means if it's Yomtiv, when Chayav Adam or Tahar Atzmei Beregel, a person has an obligation to be Tahor during the Yom Tovim, then she should not become Tomei for him if it's that time of year, because she's supposed to stay Tahor. Meaning, in other words, if they had been fully married, a husband is Matame for his wife, even if he's a Kohen, and vice versa, the wife is Matame for her husband, even if it means she's going to be Tomei during Yom Tov. But here we're saying, because there's only Orus and Arusa, then that doesn't apply. And the Braisa continues, Mesa, if she dies, Eina Yosha, then her chosin does not yaushin her.
If she dies
during the Erusin, then the husband does not yaushin the Nedunya. Because the husband, we talked about a few days ago. The point is there wasn't chuppah yet. So only then would he be yaushining the nedunya. We talked about the other day that in principle he yaushins the nedunya right away. We talked about a few days ago there was a takana of Rabbi Natam at one point that said that if she dies during the year after the wedding, then also the nedunya goes back, and then later on Rabbi Natam changes mind. Yeah, we talked about the other day a takana of Rabbi Natam on that, and we talked about, is that takana still in effect now? Different places have different minhagim about that, but anyway, the point is that definitely during the erusin, the nedunya still belongs to her father, and then therefore, if she dies during the erusin and she's childless, then it goes back to her father.
Noticing that as this practice is going on, we learned that during this time, she lives by her parents' house.
She lives by her parents' house.
She's truma because for that reason,
right?
Because she's there,
right? At that point, if she's the door, actually, we said she can't eat truma at that point.
And just
she's
the marital.
Right. She can't eat truma.
Right.
The thing, the fact that she is living in the parents' house.
Right. So, and the braisa finishes off, meshu, if he dies at that point, goiva ksubasa, then she collects her ksuba. So the implication.
Wait a minute, which time?
Which are during the erusin. During the erusin.
After the erusin.
So that's what we're saying. In other words, because. There was kedushin already. So if the ksuba was already written at that point, then the ikur and the tosfos are in effect. The nedunya is not yet in effect, because that only takes place after the nisuin, or at least after she's given to shluchei abal, as we learned a few days ago. But the ikur and the tosfos, those already belong to her. So Rav Chiya Ba'ami tells them, time of demesku. So the implication is only because he died does she collect her ksuba. Ha mesahi ein ksuba. The implication is that if she dies at that point during the erusin, she does not get a ksuba. So you're telling this chassan who's coming to us for chachamim, you're saying you're obligated to either pay her ksuba or to pay her burial expenses. Rav Chiya Ba'ami is saying to them, it seems that not. So now, based on this braisa. Now, why indeed is there no ksuba? My timer, Amar Rav Hoshea, she'ena nikore ba, because when she died, we can't apply the clause in the ksuba that says l'chshiti nosi la'acher, when you remarry somebody else, titli mashakosav lichi, then you can collect what was written for you in this ksuba. She's dead. She's not going to be able to remarry again. Therefore, unless he died or unless he divorced her, there was no shibud. So there was no shibud. So therefore, he's not actually yaushing anything from her like this. In other words, the idea would be, you could say he's chayev to bury her because he's yaushing something from her. But in this case, he's not yaushing anything because the ksuba is not yet in effect based on this braisa. And you can't say, and there's no that you're going to take what is coming to you when you remarry somebody else, because you can't remarry. Because the shibud didn't take effect yet, because that's what we're saying, because it was during the erusin. So in other words, not only is the nedunya not in effect, but even the 100 or 200, we can't really say that he yaushed it from her. The shibud had not taken effect, such that we should say that belonged to her, and now he's inheriting it from her. It's considered as though it had never been given in the first place.
It's really a one-way street.
It's right. So he's not obligated at that point to be paying for her quota. Her parents or her relatives or whatever would have to be doing that.
Absolutely, she would get...
The opposite way, what? If he died?
Right.
If he died, then she would be collecting her ksuba. Tosfos, by the way, gets into an interesting discussion about this, and this is also relevant to we've learned before. We said we seem to be daushining the ksuba. We had a few days ago that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and a Mishnah daushens a couple of phrases from the ksuba and learns a halacha from it. Here we're saying we're daushening, and we're saying, so therefore, when this clause can't be in effect because she died, then the ksuba doesn't apply. Tosfos brings up a point that actually we learned at the end of Yevamos that Beis Shammai holds that we douche in the ksuba like that, and we learn halachas from that. Beis Hillel seems to disagree. So how do you have so many tanoim that hold like Beis Shammai? So Tosfos ends up saying that actually what it seems is that in this case, this is one of the cases where the halacha is like Beis Shammai, because you have so many amiroim who disagree with them. And it seems that even Tosfos says Hillel HaZaken himself held that way as well. Hillel's Talmidim, Beis Hillel, disagreed. But Hillel himself holds like Beis Shammai in that regard. Or Tosafot says there could also be, maybe there's a distinction between, are we doushin in ksuba to take away something from her versus to give something to her? Maybe Beis Hillel would be disagreeing within that. But basically, according to Tosafot's first answer, you have something, you have a rarity where Beis Hillel holds one way, and Hillel himself and Beis Shammai hold the other way. And the halacha winds up being like Beis Shammai, says Tosafot. Usually when it says Beis Hillel holds such and such, usually it means Hillel himself as well. But here Tosafot is saying, according to one answer, that this is a rare exception. When okay, onward. You have to keep in mind, Beis Hillel, when we say the Talmidim of Hillel, we don't mean they were exclusively Hillel's Talmidim. The Pashtus, they learned by other great Chacham of those times as well. They were, as the Alter Rebbe phrases it in Tanya, you had people whose neshamas are more mitzad chesed, and they gravitated more towards Hillel, and people whose neshamas are more mitzad gvura, and they gravitated towards Shammai. But it doesn't mean that they exclusively learned by Hillel, or they exclusively learned by Shammai. So therefore, you can have the Pashtus, they learned by other Chachamim as well, and they had independent opinions based on that as well.
In all due respect, Shammai and Hillel themselves.
How did she collect her ksuba?
Agreed upon everything.
How did she collect?
One second. No, that's what we're saying in this case. Yeah.
One issue. But they themselves agreed upon everything.
Shammai and Hillel themselves had three machlokes, and actually
three.
Five.
Okay,
Shammai
five,
and Hillel
five,
themselves
five.
Had five machlokes.
Five.
Their Talmidim had many more, right?
But the Talmidim
had all. Yeah. You were saying, you're asking how would she collect her ksuba? I don't understand. What's the question?
How does she collect her ksuba if her husband dies bankrupt?
That's a good question. The short answer is there's a shibud on his property.
Yeah,
so in the time of the Gemara, up till the middle of the time of the Gaonim, she could collect from any karka that he owned, and if he didn't own it at the time, but he sold it to somebody else, there would still be a shibud on it, and she'd be able to collect from it like any other creditor. The Gaonim made a takana that the same thing would apply to Metalfin. So even if he's bankrupt, if you have property that he used to own and then was sold to somebody else, then she can collect from that. But we'll talk about that in detail later on in the Masechta. Okay, let's go on. He also Ravin Amar Rish Lakish. When Ravin came from Eretz Yisrael, he reported in the name of Rish Lakish, Arusa Shemesa Ein Lo Ksuba. That if Arusa passes away, like the scenario we just had, then she does not get a ksuba. Omelu Abayas, Abayas says to the Chachamim, who heard Robin say this, Zilu Imrule, go tell Robin, Shkila Tivusach Shadia Chizri. You may as well take your favor and throw it on the thorns. In other words, you think, Robin, that we should consider that we owe you one because you told us what Rish Lakish says, but you should know, Kvartugim, Rav Hoshia, L'shmaita B'bavel, Rav Hoshia already explained to us in Babel, this din that and brought this braisa that we said that she doesn't get a ksuba in that case, and explain why, because we learn from the words in the ksuba of shetid nasi la'achar, and we don't have that anymore. So therefore, Rabin, don't think you did us any great favors by telling us what Rish Lakish says, because we already know it. Meaning, in other words, that Rabin was one of the Chachamim who regularly traveled back and forth between Eretz Yisrael and Babel to report to the Chachamim of Babel what they're learning in Eretz Yisrael and vice versa. So Abaye is saying, in effect, Rabin. You have to make it your business, not just to tell us like a tape recorder what they said in Eretz Yisrael, but to consider, do you need to tell us this, or is it something that we already know anyway, and you don't really need to confirm it? So, okay. Next, we said in the Mishnah, Benon Nukvan Diabin Lachimi Naichola, we said that there's another Tnai Ksuba, which is that any daughters that she has from him will have the right to continue living in his house and be supported from his nechosim until they get married. And that's a tenai based thing. So eventually, once he dies and his sons inherit the estate, then they have to support their sisters until they get married. So now the Gemara says, Rav Toni Ad Tilok from the Gurin, Rav's version of the Mishnah said, as we just said, that this is in effect until they get married. The Levi Toni Ad Tivkaron. Levi learned his version of the Mishnah was that it applies until they become bogus. So the Gemara asked, Rav Afagav the Bogar. So what are you telling me? That Rav would say they're entitled to Mizernus even long after they became a Begeres, as long as they're not married yet? What if they only got married in their 20s? And the Levi Afagav the Insiv. And would Levi say, even if they got married, when they're below the age of Begeres, we know that either Begeres or marriage takes them out of the Rishus of their father. So why it sounds like each one of them is saying that only the factor that they mention means that they don't have Mizonis anymore. So no, Ella Bogo Vele Incivile Bogo. So no, it's like this. If she became a Begeres, but she's not yet married, or if she was married and is not yet a Begeres, the Kulam Ole Pli. Then there's no Machlokas, then everybody is going to agree that either Begeres or marriage takes away her rights to Mazonis, because she's not under, she wouldn't, if her father was still alive, she wouldn't be under her his reshus anymore. So therefore, it doesn't change now. Keep Pligi, the argument between Rav and Levi, Ba'arusa Vele Bogo. Where she's arusa to her husband, she says there's only erusin, there has not been nisuin yet, but and she's not yet a begeres. An interesting point over here is, would this apply if she's a katana? Does it apply only if she's a naira, or does it apply only if she, or does it apply even if she's a katana? There's a machlokas we're showing him on that point. One way of looking at it,
the numbers.
What?
Remind me the numbers.
The numbers that she becomes a naira, she becomes, she's a katana until 12, or until she develops Shtei Cyrus. She's a begeres for 6 months after. She's a naira for 6 months after that. Then she becomes a begeres.
So naira is 6 months.
Right. So now, so there are Rishonim who argue, for example, that a katana, listen, you know, I mean, she doesn't even have the das to accept kedushin on her own. They are the ones who are doing it on her behalf, the Yoshim. So do they have the right to do that and thereby take away from her mazonis? Just because of that, maybe not necessarily. Maybe only when she's a naira, where at least she has das, or maybe it applies when she's a katana as well. Anyway, so that would be the machlokas. When she's an arusa, she's not yet a begeres. Is she still entitled to mezonos? According to Rav, no, because at this point it's already tilok from the govern. She's been taken by a husband. Yes, there hasn't been nisuin yet, but even erusin already counts as tilok from the govern, according to Rav. So therefore, she has no more mezonah. So Chassan now has to support her. According to Levi, she's still entitled because she's not yet a begeres, and he doesn't care about the fact that there was erusin. And the Gemara says, "V'chein Tony Levi b'masnise." In fact, that is how Levi taught it in his collection of brises. Beside the Mishnah, Levi had a collection of brises of his own, just like we know famously that Ruchia and Reb Oshia collected brises, which became the Tesefta. So Levi had his own collection of brises. So in that brise, he taught that the Loshen is ad de Tivgaron, until they become Bergeres, the yimti zman nehen de insabon, and the time comes for them to be married. So the Gemara asks Tauti, what do you mean both of them? The time to get married is a year after the Kedushin. Ella, what he means is oy tivgron oy yimti zmnein leisnatsva. Either they become a begeres, or the time comes, the 1 year after the kedushin, when it's time for them to get married. At that point, they forfeit mezonos, but up to that point, Levi learns that they still have mezonos because they're not yet a begeres, and it's only during the erusin. And the Gemara says, "Katanoi." This is actually machlokas tanoi. Ad mosi abas nizonis. Up to what point can a daughter be supported out of the estate? Ad shteoris, until the erusin. Mishum Rabbi Lazar Amru ad shetivgar. And then they said in the name of Rabbi Lazar until she becomes a begeres. Tony Rabbi Yosef. Rabbi Yosef taught a brisa ad yehevyan until they become. Now, yehevyan is the loshen like when the Torah used the expression kisia when she becomes. When she becomes to a husband. So what does that mean? So does it mean kedushin or nisuin? Iboilu havaya de erusin or havaya de nisuin. So the question is, what does Rabbi Yosef mean by that ad de heaven? Does he mean only erusin, and that would be like Rav, that already at that point they're not entitled to mezonos anymore, or does he mean until they get married, which would be more likely?
But she's living.
She's living at home, yeah. But and the Gemara says Teiku, we're not sure what Rav Yosef meant by that brisa, but we're going to see soon that Rav Yosef himself holds one way. We're going to see. So the next thing is Amalei Rav Chiya l'Rav Yosef, Mi Shmielach Minei de Rav Yehuda Arusa Yesh LaMezonis HaEin LaMezonis. Have you heard anything from Rav Yehuda? Rav Yehuda was Rav Yosef's Rebbe. So have you heard anything from him about the question, Arusa Yesh LaMezonis HaEin LaMezonis, does an Arusa, so in this case, she's not yet a Begeres, but she's already an Arusa to her future husband. Is she entitled to Mezonis from the estate, or is she no longer entitled and her husband has to support her, or she has to support herself? Omale, so Rabbi Yosef says, Mishma Leshmieli, I haven't heard anything from Rabbi Yehuda one way or the other. Elam is Svara Lesla. But we can assume, based on Svara, that she doesn't get. Given the Irsa, because we can assume once her chosen did the Erisin, Lenichale de Titzil. He doesn't want that she should be treated in a degrading way. In other words, if she doesn't have Mazonis from her, family, how would she earn money? She might have to go begging. We can assume her chosen is not going to want that, and therefore he's going to support her. Therefore, we can say that she's not entitled to Mazonis from the estate, because we assume the chosen is going to be willing to support her rather than that she's yet. Omale, but Rav Chiska says to Rav Yosef, im mishma l'shmielach, on the contrary, if you didn't hear anything about it, it's one thing. If you heard something from Rav Yehuda, we'd have to accept what he says. But since you didn't hear, and you're saying based on Svara, on the contrary, Miss Svara isva, you could say Svara would tell us that she does have. After all, when he did the Eidosin, he doesn't know for sure that they're going to end up getting married. What happens, for example, if he finds a mum in her? And then it is Mevatel the Kiddushin. On that basis, we're going to learn later on in the Masechta that if he finds a mum in her, which he didn't know about at the time of the Kiddushin, then that's a valid reason to be Mevatel it. So therefore, you could argue, le shodi zuzi bichti. So therefore, you could say maybe he's not going to throw away his money for nothing. He's not necessarily going to be ready to support her at that point because he's not sure they're going to end up ever getting married. And therefore, maybe he does expect that her brothers are going to continue to support her. And therefore, by the way, Tosfos points out the reason why Rav Chisda is asking the question, didn't we just say that there's machlokes tanoim about it? So either he didn't know about it, not all the Amoraim knew all the braises, or he's wondering who the halacha is like. So again, Rav Yosef is telling him by logic we would say that she doesn't get, and Rav Chisda is saying on the contrary, by logic we would say she does get. The Ikadamri, another version of the discussion, is Omalei, that Rav Yosef says to Rav Chisda, Mishma Leshmili, I didn't hear anything about it, but Misvara Isla, but the second version is that on the contrary, we flip around what Rav Yosef and what Rav Chisda said. So Rav Yosef says logically she should get the kivin like kimlei begava, because again, the husband doesn't know for sure that he's gonna wind up marrying her, shadi zuzi b'chi. Therefore, maybe we should assume he doesn't want to throw away his money for nothing. Omalei, and Rav Chisda tells him, on the contrary, if you haven't heard anything one way or the other, misvara lesla, then we should say svara would tell us she doesn't get kivin to irsa, because once he was ma'arasur, le'nichale de titzil, he doesn't want her to be degraded and to have to go begging, so therefore necessarily he's gonna support her. That, in fact, is the accepted halacha, because since we really have a suffix about it, we're not sure what the halacha should be. So we can't take away money from Yisoyimim. In general, we always have to look out for the interests of the Yisoyimim. So therefore, we can't take away from them without a solid proof. So therefore, by default, we say that the husband has to support her, and if he doesn't, for whatever reason, then she's going to have to earn her own way during the Eidosin. So we're talking, does it make a difference in the age of the Yisoyimim? L'chora not. L'chora was saying that in any case, it's called Toyan in the Yorish. We'll always try to give every possible argument in favor of the Yorishim, because we can say, after all, the Yorishim don't fully know what their father was doing, all the ins and outs of what he was doing, and therefore there might be claims on their behalf that they wouldn't know to make, and Basin is obligated to bring them up on their behalf. So therefore, so the halacha winds up being that she's not entitled to mezonos from the Yorshim. Keep in mind, the Yorshim are not necessarily her brothers. If the guy died, they could be her half brothers. They could be her half brothers or something, right? But so that's how it is. So either her chosin supports her, or she has to make her own way.
Okay.